and you're part of the majority, and you're part of you're used to getting things your way, you can be completely ignorant to the other side. And if you have no black friends, you know, no touch points with black people, you only listen to what you hear on the news, you are an ignorant person.
Welcome to the Immigrant Experience in America, an immigrant human library, where we amplify and humanize the experiences of immigrants in the United States and around the world. Listen in as we add another story to our Immigrant Human Library.
Hello, my friends, and welcome to Season 3 of the Immigrant Experience in America, where we amplify and humanize the experiences of immigrants living in the United States and around the world. Today, we are bringing to you another amazing story, and it's that of Nina Renner. Welcome, Nina.
Hi. Hello, Simone. Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to have this talk.
I am so excited to get into it. I have no doubt this is going to be amazing. So, Nina, give us a little bit about your background and what brings you to the United States.
Okay. So I was born in Freetown, Sierra Leone. I'm the last of four girls. My mom and dad actually met in London, England, and it had my two older sisters in England, and then decided to relocate back to Sierra Leone, where they both had familial ties or family members that came through that. Their parents are from different places, but I'll talk about that later. It's kind of a weird, interesting story. But their parents had an affinity for Sierra Leone, so they moved back to Sierra Leone. And they had me and my most immediate sister. My two older sisters, when they became of age, 16, 18, they moved back to London on their own. And there's quite a gap between us. But when my mom decided that she was no longer going to be with my dad, she left Sierra Leone and moved back to London, where the majority of her family are from and her siblings were born. And I lived there until I was 22. I moved here in 2005, October. And it's a funny story, but I got laid off from my job, my first job out of college, and I came to support my sister who was living out here on her own and had just had my nephew and my niece. And so I came just to support her, and I just thought it would be temporary. And then I met a man. Isn't that always the story? My husband. And so I got a job, got a green card, and then eventually we got married, and I, you know, became a citizen myself.
Wow, 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 wow. Love does it to all of us, doesn't it?
It does.
A whole nother country across the world. Wow, well, thanks for sharing. So give us a sense. Do you remember your time in Sierra Leone? I've been to Freetown. I spent some time there. And give us a sense for what life was like growing up and what, you know, a little bit about the country.
To be honest with you, I have overall memories. So for one thing, Sierra Leone is a very community-oriented country. You know, I was always at an auntie's house, an uncle's house, and, you know, we had neighbors next door that would take care of any of us. So it was very, very community-based, very loving. I just remember being extremely content. You know, I didn't feel like I was a poor little immigrant girl, because I really wasn't, or a poor little African girl. My family were middle to upper class. My dad's dad, the name Renner Thomas, which is my maiden name, which I recently changed to my married name, which is Lewis. It carried a status to it, because it's really well known in Sierra Leone. Like, the family is really well known. So I grew up with electronic bikes and, you know, just different things that other kids may not have had, the type of toys that you would find in Western world. So I just remember being very, very content. I wanted for nothing. My mom used to sew all of our clothes because she loved to sew. She's a microbiologist by trade, but in the evening she would sew, and she would sew all of our clothing. So all of my clothing were couture. You know, and made in that way. And that's kind of like what my memory is, just the community orientation of the place. It's just very community driven.
Okay. And anything about like foods, language spoken there, you know, maybe what the country is, you know, a little bit of history about Sierra Leone.
Yeah, I mean, I still eat the food because my mom still very much cooks it, and I've learned to cook some of the foods myself. We cook things that are called, or colloquially known as plasas, which can be one of my favorites, something called crin crin, which took me forever to find it here in Atlanta, but it's called jute leaf here. And all of the plasases have like the same base, the way you start to cook it, but you can use the same base to pretty much cook spinach stew, okra stew, oh my God, sour. There's just so many things that you can cook with that. And so I still very much eat Sierra Leonean foods, and I'm trying to teach my first generation American kids. I should have to teach them. They love it. They eat, and so does my husband, who's American, eat Sierra Leonean foods. And when my mom comes, it's like they get the real authentic experience. It's taken me a little while to become a culinary master at some of these dishes, but I'm getting better and better. So the food, in that sense, you know, it's still part, very much part of my life. And it's, at one point, Sierra Leone had the number one, Sierra Leone was named the number one place for healthy foods. So it just kind of tells you a lot of stuff is green based. A lot of stuff is leaf based. There's stuff like, Nigerians call it moi moi. We call it olele. It's, black eyed peas. You mince it up and it becomes like a solid form, and you can add fish to it or egg to it or different things like that. You know, you can add palm oil to it or not. You can just do pure oils, things like that. They're very, very healthy. It's just a black-eyed bean solid form. And so, like, there's, you know, the stuff like akara that I love. You have banana akara, which is called rice akara, and then you have, again, black-eyed peas-based akara, which is like one of my favorites as well. So there's, it's just like a vastness and a richness to that food, but they're very traditionally very, very healthy. In relation to the second half of your question, you asked me if I can remember if I know anything about the history. So unfortunately, I know very little about the history. I know that at one point we had the number one university in Africa, but along the way, obviously, when we left in 1989, my dad, really, who's military pastoral in nature. He's now a certified pastor, but at the time he had been military and kind of like had heard some of the whisperings that were coming down the lines. And so when my mom decided to leave him, also, you know, to separate from him, it just coincided with all of that happening. And then there was a coup from like end of 1989, beginning of 1990, well into almost the 2000s. I hope I have those dates right. You know, it went through, it was war torn for so long, right? Mm-hmm. And I have family and friends who had to flee the war and ended up in different places like America and London. We were already there, thank God. So we missed all of that. And my dad since has told me stories about, I have half siblings who experienced that, who would have to hide and run from the militia that were coming through the towns and raiding the towns and things like that. So but prior to that, it was a very rich, very you know, it's where all of the diasporas who had who were taken in the slave trade to America and other parts of the world. It's where they were all mostly released back into Africa. Most people were taken back to the port of Freetown, hence the name. And so it just has a very rich culture and a very rich history that kind of stems from that. But, you know, it also has, like I said, you know, was number one university at one point in Africa and things like that. So it's very, very rich culture.
Yes. And it's sad, the civil war that impacted the country so much. Yeah, if you read about it, it's really sad. And you can see the impact years, decade later, right?
Yes. I went for the first time. Later. Yeah, I went for the first time in 2019. And that was my first time home in the 30 years since I left. And It was really sad, actually. It was very, very sad. It just wasn't what I remember. Everything seems grander and bigger. And it was very, very much poverty driven now. One of our good family friends, who is the mayor of Sevilla of Freetown, she has been working really, really hard to just clean up, to have common knowledge of hygiene, to kind of bring in industry and tourism into the country. And it's, you know, she. I believe she's doing a wonderful job, but it's a definitely Herculean task that's ahead of her to do that. And one of her biggest things is that people like myself, who leave the country, don't go back, and therefore then enrich the country with the knowledge that we do get, and the skills, and the trade, and the learnings that we get from third world, from first world countries, you know. So I definitely agree with that. And it's a transition, you know, especially when you have intercultural families like my own. It's not something that you can just pick up and do.
Yes, definitely. It's not an easy decision because it's a let's be honest, it's a different, it's a change in infrastructure and it's a change in lifestyle. You've been away for 30 plus years. Culture is different. You have children and all of that. So it is a big move. But the brain drain is serious and it does impact so many developing countries. They prepare us to leave and to do well abroad, but the percentage of return is not quite the, you know, as promising.
No, and that is one of her biggest points, you know. I think that we should be prepared, as you said. We're prepared to leave, but we're not really shown how to come back, you know. So I 100% agree.
Right, yes. And so from my short time there, back in, I want to say, 2007, I remember taking a Creole class. Can you talk about the different languages and how diverse the country is? The African continent is so diverse, you don't hear a lot of people talking about it, but I mean, from languages, and I mean, it looks like, yes, it's a black country, quote unquote black, as you know, this construct that we have here in the US with skin color, but there's so many different tribal groups and different dialects and what and languages that speak people speak. I'll let you educate us a bit about Sierra Leone in particular.
I can tell you that when I was growing up, I learned English in school. So that was the predominant language that I spoke. But before I left when I was 7, the other language that I was being taught was French. And at home, our predominant language is Creole. And Creole is, I'm sure it's very similar to Patois. It's an English-based broken language that was used by a lot of the slaves, as I understand it. And so it's spoken by about approximately 90% of Sierra Leoneans. But if I'm, and I'm gonna try not to quote the wrong number, but I think it's about 23 languages that exist in the country overall. I can't name them all, but it's very rich in dialects. But the majority of the population understands Creole, which is the language that you'll find in the markets and, you know, in between friends and different things like that. Like when I went, Creole was the language I spoke, and everybody else spoke Creole too. But the funny thing is, when you've been abroad and you come back, they can hear the inflections in your dialect that kind of lend to the fact that you're from abroad, that you're not one of the natives. So it's very, very interesting. You know, I may have spoken the language, but I didn't really speak the language, you know. So yeah, it's got a rich language pool.
Yes. I can totally relate. When I travel back to the island these days, I as much as I try, you know, there's something there that they can tell you've been away, right? You've picked up
Yep.
other ways of speaking, and it doesn't come out the same anymore. So,
Nope.
yeah, I've been mourning the loss of my native tongue, but we'll see. We'll see how I work on keeping it. Okay, wonderful. So, what was it like for you, Nina, as you came over and after you left London? So you went from Sierra Leone to the UK. Can you talk to us a bit about, before I come to the US side, tell us, you know, what it was like for you transitioning from Sierra Leone. I think it was London to Sierra Leone and then back to London. Is that right? That you were born in Sierra Leone?
I was born in Sierra Leone. So Sierra Leone. So my sisters were London to Sierra Leone and then back to London. But I was born in Sierra Leone and I just went to London. It was really hard. I mean, I was a young child, you know, my mom then was a single parent. And my IQ, is really high. And so when I first moved there, they had me 4 grades above my actual age grade, which resulted in me being bullied intensely. I remember once in one of the classes that I was in, a boy, I don't remember what I did or what I said. We must have had class prior to that. It was lunchtime. I bent over to pick up my my lunchbox, and he took my head and rammed it into the corner of a table. And so I had concussion for about 2 days. And that scared the crap out of my mom. And so she forced the school to put, it's not like how it is here, like where my kids are in, you know, my daughter's in advanced classes. She's able to be in her grade, but be in advanced classes, right? It was very much that you moved into that year. And so that resulted in some really, really severe bullying that I experienced for some time. And my mom, as a single parent, just getting back to the, you know, to the country and trying to get us established. And she just couldn't handle that. And so I was moved back to my actual grades, and the way that we expand my creativity and my intellectual prowess was by having me do stuff like play the violin. I played like 6 instruments at one time. I was doing so many athletic sports and things like that just to kind of keep me occupied, because I wasn't stimulated academically. So we just found other ways to kind of meet that need, but she just didn't want me to be bullied. But the upside of that transition was that I then got to meet all of my mom's family, who were all very, you know, accepting and welcoming. And I got, like, I come from a big family on both sides. My dad's family is huge. My mom's side's family is huge. So both of them have a lot of family in Sierra Leone. Both of them have a lot of family in England. And so, but I had never met my mom's sister. She's one of 9, and sisters and brothers. So I got to meet all of them, all of my first cousins, got to know about this rich world that was just completely outside of what I'd already experienced in Sierra Leone. So it was really, really nice to have that. But it took me a while to become acclimated to the culture, and I used to get teased for having an African accent, which is why I sound more British, and why my British accent could be influenced by American accent, and I can sound American too, right? So it was just different things like that I remember when we first got to London that was just really, really hard.
Like being scared as a mom, I cannot even imagine.
Yeah, she was. Yeah, she definitely. I mean, she made the right choice for the circumstances that we had, without a doubt. It was just best that way.
Right. So she's fleeing impending civil war in Sierra Leone, and then come to London, thinking it's going to be safe for her children, and then, you know, trying to figure out school and otherwise for her children, and then to be experiencing this type of, it's traumatic, yeah?
It's very traumatic.
Cool, yeah.
It's very traumatic. She did try to move me. She moved me to another school at one point, but we talked about it recently, because it's funny, when you're a child, you just, these things are happening and you don't really talk about it or you don't express it. And she said that I was so miserable when she moved me, because it was just too many moves and too many transitions, that she took me back to the school where I was and then had me drop down in grades, because that was the only way I could stay in that school and I could at least establish stability. And then, you know, so for her, it was more about, oh, you know, I moved her and now she's here. She has no friends. She's already made friends over there. And now she's struggling. So she moved me back to where a lot of the stuff was happening, but just put me in my right grade. And after that, it did stop. Like, I didn't really have issues as it relates to bullying after that. Not much anyway. I think kids are just kids generally, not in the extreme way I was when, previously.
Right. And how long were you there? I know you said you came over for, was this school to the US? How long were you in the UK after moving back?
So I was there from when I was 17 till I was 22, 23. So, sorry, 7 to 22, 23. So that's 17 years. Is my math right? Don't ask me. So that's how long I was there. And, you know, moving here was not on purpose, per se. It was more a case of I got laid off from the job. I graduated from King's College London with a bachelor's in neuroscience, and I was doing pharmaceutical sales for a period of time. And the drug that I was on, which was I was on Fosamax and the sister drug of Arcoxia, I've forgotten what its name is, but that drug was a blockbuster drug that was bringing in billions, and that drug was pulled from the market. And when that happened, my job with my as a pharmaceutical sales rep was basically came to an end. But the way that they did it was they laid off my entire team, but there was me and two other people that they said, because my performance was really high, they said, okay, give us 6 months and we'll have another contract for you. And so I was like, okay, 6 months, I'll just come and visit my sister in Atlanta, who's here, not knowing I would meet my husband. And then my sister was like, don't do long distance relationships, stay here, get a job, help me with the kids, you know, I want family. And so I stayed. I started to interview, like, you know, they told me to, like, they recommended, and I did. And I didn't want to do long distance relationships either, because I'd done one before and I was like, it's not fun. And so I was like, okay, let me just see where this relationship goes. And one thing led to another, and here we are, so many years in. So that's basically how I ended up here. Wow. And that was a whole nother transition.
Right. So tell me, how was it? How was it, you know, after coming over? It was great that you had a sister and some sort of stability. So that's good, a good start. So how was it in the, I mean, and you already spoke English, so that's a good thing. How was it for you transitioning from the UK to the United States?
I think the biggest transition for me was, you know, being Black in America. Like, I really did not realize that racism was still very much alive. So when I came in, I used to have friends that I was like, racism doesn't exist, you know, because I had experienced it three times in my life in England. And I can literally, I once was with the police, and they pulled me over when I had a when I was a pharmaceutical sales rep. I had a company car. And so I was like 23, 22 with a company car, brand new company car with, like, you know, a couple of hundred miles on it, driving through the streets of London. And I was able, and I was profiled, but I was able to, like, argue my way with the police officers and get out of that ticket. The second time was one of my professors, but he was married to a Black woman, so I'm not really sure what that was about. And the third time was I was called the N-word on a bus by a bus driver, which was shocking to me. And then I came to the U.S. and I started working. I worked first at Morehouse College, which is all Black, and that's got its own story to it, because it was, where I worked was very dysfunctional. But then I went into mainstream other companies, and the transition to, you know, the dog words, you know, being articulate and having people say certain things to me and them having different meanings and the treatments being very disparate and not understanding the source of that disparate treatment, I would always apologize, because I would always think, okay, I'm doing something wrong, right? And I would think that it was down to me. And the day that it hit me that it was racism, like, oh my word, this stuff is still alive. It exists. It breathes. It has a life of its own. And it's only in the last few years that I've really, really understood what systematic racism means. You know what I mean? I think, you know, initially I just used to have issues at work because I can see it so clearly. And I would look at other, you know, African Americans and be like, why aren't you guys, like, rising up against this and like, marching? Like, because I didn't recognize it initially as racism. I just recognized it as disparate treatment. I just couldn't understand why. And it took me a while to really grasp what it was. And then once I did, it's just, I went through my own angry Black female phase. I'm out of it now. and I will be very clear. I think that the right response to disparate treatment that's based on race is righteous anger. I really do believe that. But I also recognize that, unfortunately, people have been pre-programmed that when you do have that reaction, you're then minimized and not listened to. So it's kind of like a balancing act that you have to do to be able to really get your voice heard and to get the point across. So needless to say, it was a hell of a transition.
Wow. And the last time we talked, you were sharing quite a nice realization that you had about really how to respond in contexts like those where people are coming at you and you know, what you realize it does to your psyche and your mental space and why you've chosen to not let anger take you over. Can you talk to us about that? I think people will find that very helpful because I know there's a lot of immigrants who are facing things like this. I didn't even have the word to describe it, like you're saying, what I was experiencing.
Yeah.
I just knew it was wearing me down. Something was not right, and I couldn't quite put my finger on it. And so, you know, just give us a little bit more about how you've maneuvered and educated yourself about how to, or even learn from folks who are native-born Blacks in this country, how they manage it and really kind of protect themselves, you know?
Yeah, I think native-born Blacks probably have are the greatest source of like learning for me, because I'm very open. So you ask me a question, I'll tell you the honest answer. So like when I worked for one of the companies, and I won't name any more companies, so I don't give myself a trouble. But when I worked for one of the companies, I remember I used to have she wasn't even my supervisor, it was my supervisor's counterpart. And she would like walk behind me. I used to take the bus and the train to work. So I was supposed to be there at 8 o'clock, sometimes because it's public transport. And I took public transport to avoid Atlanta traffic, not because I didn't have a car, I did. But I would take the public transport and I would get there 8:05, 8:07, just a few minutes after 8. And she would have already reported me. And then if I got up to go to the bathroom, she would walk around and just very like backwards mentality that I can't explain, right? And I would never understand, you know. And then when they would ask me questions, like in my lunch hour, if I was going to go somewhere, I would be honest because I thought honesty was the best policy. So I would be very transparent. Oh, I'm running to the bank. Oh, I have to go to the post office. And I would always recognize that my native-born Americans, they did two things differently. Black Americans, they would say like, oh, I'm running an errand, which tells you what I'm doing, but it's none of your business where I'm going, right? Because what I found was when I would then be late back from the bank, the kind of comments that I would receive or the kind of treatment I would get back would be based off of my own words that would then be used against me, right? Yes. Yeah. Whereas if you say I'm running an errand, you have no idea what I'm doing. It's none of your business, right? And that's one of the things that I kind of learned. I learned that as time went on and as I progressed through different roles, I've realized that Black Americans often have like one phrase answers for as a response to things that usually typically have me stumped. Like when someone says something to me that I find to be offensive or rude, like I remember one time one of my colleagues came up to me and started stroking my hair and was like, "What is this? Is this a weave braid?" And I had tree braids in at the time. So it's like, you know, cornrows and then some of the it's like, you know, a full goddess braid at this moment in time, like with all the pieces out. And she literally was touching my hair like this. And I just was in shock. So my reaction was like shock. And I just stayed quiet and I shut down. Whereas I've seen some of my African American friends handle it and they'll be like, "What do you think you're doing?" They will actually say something. And for the longest time, the experiences that I would encounter would have me in a state of disbelief and then have me shut down. And one of the things I realized is that the minute you, I don't want to say show weakness because it's the wrong terminology, but when you don't address those things, they continue to compound and get worse and worse and worse. So then your experience becomes 10,000 times worse, especially in corporate America. And so I had to learn to respectfully have a boundary and like articulate for myself and also choose the hills I was going to die on, right? But to never let things sort of slide, because that only ever gets worse. And then for me, of recent, after I went through my anger black woman phase and a lot of therapy, I came to the realization that, you know, for me personally, I want to always address people in love. So while sometimes what people are doing is just completely wrong, there is a absolute ignorance, right, that exists. Because when you're part of the majority and you're part of you're used to getting things your way, you can be completely ignorant to the other side. And if you have no black friends, you know, no touch points with black people, you only listen to what you hear on the news, you are an ignorant person. You really are. You haven't, you know, I can tell you a story about one of my neighbors that I had. This was during the Mike Brown era. I was really close with this neighbor. She's Caucasian. You know, we used to talk all the time, and I had a lot of respect for her. And one day I came home, got out of my car, came home, and there was a whole bunch of my neighbors from the neighborhood standing around and talking. And as I walked by, they went quiet. And so I was like, okay, I'm not going to really, nothing I got to think about it. And I went into my house. At the time, my husband and I only had our daughter, so I only had a girl. And the next day I said to her, hey, Katie, what was that conversation you guys were having? And she was like, hey, you know, we were talking about that Mike Brown situation. And she proceeds to kind of talk about some of the things that they were talking about. And then she says, because, you know, black men are dangerous. Now, she knew my husband. You know what I mean? Like, my husband was living in the house with me. Her husband and my husband had communicated. I had communicated with them. And it just shocked me that she really just stood there and opened her mouth and told me that black men were dangerous. And I knew one day I'll have a son and I have a husband at home that's a black man, right? So how can you tell me they're dangerous? So I didn't respond to her. I let the conversation, you know, finish and treated her just the same. Went home and really thought about how I was going to communicate to her how what she said was just absolute utter nonsense. And so the next day I kind of like had a conversation with her, and it was sort of along the lines of, okay, Katie, you have two sons, right? Have they ever been in trouble with the law? Her answer was yes. And I said to her, what did they do to your sons? She told me they drove her eldest, who was the one who had been in trouble, back to her house and dropped him off because her husband is well known in society, right? Like in the community. I said, if that had been a black child in the same society, this is what would have happened. They would have gotten in trouble for resisting arrest when they were just scared, right? Like, you know, they would have had X amount of felonies added to them, you know, this. And then if they had a single mom, their mom's already working 2-3 jobs, which is the case of my mom, just to make ends meet. She ain't got time or money to come down there and fight for them the way that she would like to, right? So the poor boy pleads out, then you have a record, then your life begins with that already happening. So I was able to like walk her through the disparity and the differences. You know, we obviously didn't get really deep as to why it is that most parents are single parents and all that stuff, and how black marriages are like twice as likely to fail and all that stuff. We just had that single conversation, but I didn't attack her. And I literally asked her a bunch of questions to lead her down to the answer. And that was really, I don't know if I changed her mind. I probably didn't, but I was happy with the responses. And at least I got a chance to plant a seed. Like, hey, you ignorant, think about this a different way.
Join us again next time for part 2 of this episode.
Friends, as always, please subscribe, comment, and share if you enjoyed this interview. If you're passionate about telling immigrant stories, our team is looking for help. If you're willing to help with podcast production, social media, or Patreon management, please reach out to us. You can also donate on our Patreon if it's easier for you. All the links are in the description below. Thank you.
We thank our listeners around the world, and we appreciate your continued support as we build our human library. Please remember to give us a 5-star review, subscribe, and share with your friends, family, and circle of influence.